Hello and welcome to the Philosophy 208 podcast. Today we'll be talking about the succession of the 14th Dalai Lama. However, to understand this complex geopolitical situation, I think there's five separate points that we need to go over. The first is why Tibet has a claim to be an independent nation under Dalai Lama. The second is why China believes that it has a claim to Tibet due to historical events that happened under the Qing era. And then we'll go over the 14th Dalai Lama and the CCP and just the history of what happened between those two. And then we'll try to view the Panchen Lama and his succession in the 1990s and what happened there. And then we can finally discuss what's next for the Dalai Lama. The first point we need to address is Tibet and why it has a claim to its own independence. Sanam Gyatso, who is the third incarnation of High Lama and the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism, traveled around in the 1500s as a missionary, spreading the teachings of the Gelugpa order of Buddhism. But in 1578, he accepted an invitation from Altan Khan, the chief of the Tumal Mongols, and at this meeting, Gyatso and Khan hit it off and developed a respect for each other, and Khan named Gyatso Ta Li, which translates to ocean. Khan called him this to state that he was an ocean of wisdom. Ocean of wisdom was eventually added to Gyatso's title, changing it from Lama to Dalai Lama. In return, Gyatso gave Khan the title King of the Dharma, or divine purity. This relationship between the Gelugpa order and the Mongols will become essential in establishing the Gelugpa school as the dominant Buddhist school in Tibet and establishing it as a political force within Tibet, with the Dalai Lama as the spiritual and political leader. This would be strengthened when Sanam Gyatso would pass, but be reincarnated as Altan Khan's great-grandchild, Yanden Gyatso, the fourth Dalai Lama. However, the connection between the Mongols and the Gelugpa school would not come to political fruition until the fifth Dalai Lama, Ngawang Lhasong Gyatso. Besides being a prolific writer, the fifth Dalai Lama was the first Dalai Lama to rule a unified Tibet. Tibet, at the time of the fifth Dalai Lama, was ruled by the King of Song. In 1621, however, a Mongol army would enter Tibet, claiming to come to protect the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism. But by 1640, the King of Song was defeated by this Mongol force, and South, Central, and East Tibet were completely unified under the rule of the fifth Dalai Lama and his Mongols. Now that the fifth Dalai Lama was in charge of Tibet with his Mongol friends to support him, the Gelugpa school will become the dominant Tibetan Buddhist school, and opposing sects of Buddhism in Tibet were forced to adopt his teachings. For example, the Yongpasa school, whose doctrines were juxtaposed to the Gelugpa school, had their doctrines banned, and they were forced to convert to the Gelugpa order, and their monasteries returned to Gelugpa monasteries. The Qing dynasty of China even invited the fifth Dalai Lama to Beijing, recognizing Tibet as a growing power in the East. After the death of the Mongol warlords, the Mongol force supporting the fifth Dalai Lama began to fraction and splinter until they completely fell apart. The Dalai Lama and the Gelugpa school remained in power, controlling Tibet from Lhasa. During the fifth Dalai Lama's reign, the position of Dalai Lama was stressed to be connected with the Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Bodhisattvas are people who have achieved enlightenment but choose to forgo final nirvana to help humanity still stuck in the cycle of samsara. To seal this idea, the fifth Dalai Lama started construction on Potala in Lhasa, which would house the Dalai Lama and be the seat of the Tibetan government. Potala shares its name with a holy mountain in southern India, which Tibetans have always associated with the home of Avalokiteshvara. Through the histories from the 3rd to 5th Dalai Lama, it can be seen that Tibet has established itself as an independent entity with its own government and governmental structures and institutions.
Now that we've looked at the history between the third and fifth Dalai Lama and understand the historical claim that Tibet has to be an independent state under the Gulapa school of Tibetan Buddhism, we can look at China and its historical claim on why it believes it has rights to rule over Tibet. China's claims to Tibet come under the rule of the sixth Dalai Lama, Tsongyang Gyatso. He renounced during his time as Dalai Lama, he renounced his monastic duties, and compared to the fifth Dalai Lama, he was an incompetent leader. He wanted to focus on women and poetry. So, China's claims comes when a Mongol chief who managed to unite the Mongols somewhat, Hsan Ling, vied to the Qing dynasty emperor Kang Ji to invade Tibet and overthrow the sixth Dalai Lama, who he believed was an abomination for not meeting his duties as the Dalai Lama. The emperor of Kangxi agreed as long as he would become a submissive state to the Qing government. Due to this invasion during the time of the sixth Dalai Lama, communist China in the future would use this as an excuse, as a reason of why they have claim or authority over Tibet. Now that we've discussed China's historical claim from the Qing dynasty to Tibet, we can begin to discuss the 14th Dalai Lama and his interactions with the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP. The 14th Dalai Lama, whose ceremonial name is Tenzin Gyatso, would assume the title Dalai Lama at age 4 at a ceremony in Lhasa, Tibet. He would not take control of the government and the rest of his duties until 1950. Meanwhile, in Beijing, in 1950, radio broadcasts began to announce that the People's Liberation Army would begin invading Tibet the next year to rid it of imperialists and reactionaries. In 1951, the PLA invaded Tibet through the crushing Tibetan militias before the end of the year, and 1,000 PLA soldiers marched down the Tibet capital of Lhasa, waving pictures of Chairman Mao and Premier Zhu Enlai. The Dalai Lama, throughout all of this, was still trying to mediate the situation, and in 1954, he even went to Beijing on an invitation from Mao. The meeting was friendly. However, as the Dalai Lama was leaving the room, allegedly Mao turned and looked at the Dalai Lama and told him that religion is a sickness. Back in Tibet, land collectivization for farms was beginning to take place. During this process, thamizing, or struggle sessions, was beginning to take place for those who were allegedly reactionaries. These people would be wealthy landowners, local leaders, and religious figures. The historian John Avedon notes that a thamizing session went like this. It was a carefully orchestrated undertaking, much like a collective passion play. Thamizing proper took place with people seated on the ground before a tribunal of Chinese officials ensconced behind a table. An opening speech was made by the ranking Chinese. In it, the people were informed that Thamizing was not a matter of one or two meetings, but would continue until a full confession, followed by repentance, had been obtained, until the accused himself, with the help of his revolutionary brothers, had cleansed his mind of reactionary thoughts. Furthermore, it was designed to teach the serfs to stand up unafraid of their masters and expose past injustices. On this dramatic note, with the official gesturing angrily and yelling, "Bring that bad person in," the prisoner would be led to the head of the crowd and made to bend over the waist, hands on knees, eyes onto the ground. A list of crimes was then read from the charge sheets. The official saying at the conclusion was, "These are the crimes committed by this person." It is now for the people to help him admit his evil ways and decide the punishment he should receive. At this, the signal, the first accuser, invariably an activist in Chinese employ, would spring up, race forward, and denounce the exploiter by yelling such epithets as, "Kill the stinking dog, skin him alive, your mother's corpse, your father's heart, confess your crimes." After recounting the supposed suffering he had been subjected to, the witness would beat the victim, rebels often being thrashed by their guards with the butt end of the rifle. In these cases, it would frequently be the task of those at the meeting to execute the victim. In addition to the theonomizing, it was not uncommon for Chinese soldiers to antagonize monks that were walking on the street. There were even reports of nuns and monks being forced to have intercourse with each other on the streets. Naturally, there was a guerrilla resistance to the PLA. Tensions between occupied Tibet and China were heating up in 1955. As tensions continued to heat up until 1959 rolled around, the situation began to look futile between the guerrilla fighters and the heavy hand of the occupying force of the Chinese army. The Tibetan freedom fighters had small arms like handguns and rifles. In 1959, the Dalai Lama was requested to attend a theater show with a Chinese general, but he was also requested to not bring any armed guards of his own. The Dalai Lama agreed, but word got out, and the people of Lhasa formed profuse crowds gathered outside the Dalai Lama's summer palace, the Norbalinga. Before a while, there was over 30,000 Tibetans arrived, and there are formed crowds outside the palace and refused to let the Dalai Lama go to the theater. The Chinese army started to use mortars against the crowd to free the Dalai Lama from what they called a reactionary clique. The Dalai Lama, seeing that the negotiations with the Tibetans was futile, then escaped the summer palace dressed as a plain soldier. On March 24th, 1959, 2 days after the Dalai Lama escaped, the Chinese, believing that the Dalai Lama was still inside, began to fire on the actual summer palace itself. He then realized that negotiations with China were pointless and fully escaped to India. On March 28th, 1959, Xu Enlai, the premier of the People's Republic of China, announced over a radio broadcast that the Tibetan government had been completely dissolved and that China was under direct Chinese control. The Dalai Lama now lived in exile in India. Following the Dalai Lama's lead and attempting to escape Chinese rule, many Tibetans fled as refugees to Nepal or India. Sadly, a lot of these refugees following 1959 would not make it on the long journey through the mountains, or they would die due to adjusting to life off the Tibetan plateau. Tibetan leaders realized that they would have to come up with a plan and government for the Tibetan community in exile. Thankfully, the Indian government gifted Dharamsala, a piece of hilly land in the foothills of the Himalayas in northern in India. In Dharamsala, the residence of the Dalai Lama would be the seat of the Tibetan government in exile and a center for Tibetan culture and religious texts that were smuggled out of Tibet during the diaspora. The majority of Tibetan exiles live in southern India, though, because Dharamsala is not big enough to support a population or large farming. So a majority of the Tibetan exiles live in southern India in a province of Karnataka. The rest live in Nepal, Bhutan, and many other Western countries scattered. The exiles in southern India have a collective spirit where they've built communes that are highly productive, good-making centers, and agriculture. To rebuild culture, Drebung, Seru, and Ganden monasteries have all been rebuilt in southern India, and many Many young Tibetan exiles are joining the monastic tradition, and there's more increased opportunities for women to live a monastic life. Another important feature of the new Tibetan government exile is the new Tibet Constitution of 1963. This constitution provides property rights for its citizens and reduces the Dalai Lama's position to a spiritual one only. The Dalai Lama can also now be impeached with a two-thirds vote. Both these provisions, reducing the Dalai Lama's position of power and being able to impeach a Dalai Lama, were added by the Dalai Lama himself. Going back to the geographical location of Tibet, during the 1960s and 1970s, Tibet was hit especially hard during Mao's Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was a movement against the remnants of a pre-socialist Chinese society. The Cultural Revolution consisted of combating the four olds: old ideology, old culture, old habits, and old customs. And from 1966 to 1969 was the Red Guard phase of the Cultural Revolution. And Red Guards were idealistic youth who went on a rampage throughout China, combating the olds of society. Tibet was hit especially hard. The Han Chinese already viewed themselves as culturally superior to the Tibetans. And during the Cultural Revolution, there was destruction and vandalization of monasteries and temples, beatings of monks and religious leaders, destruction of religious iconography and other religious symbols. Another especially brutal part of the Red Guard phase of the Cultural Revolution was mass reports of gang rapes of Tibetan women. Despite the human rights abuses that occurred in the 1950s and 60s, and still have continued till today, the Dalai Lama is seeking a peaceful solution with Communist China. In 1989, he introduced a 5-point plan for an acceptance of Chinese rule of Tibet, on the conditions that they cessate human rights violations and they return some internal affairs back to the Tibetans. This plan was denied, but it won the Dalai Lama the Nobel Peace Prize. Also occurring in 1989, the death of the 10th Panchen Lama. This would cause another dispute between the CCP and the 14th Dalai Lama. The CCP wanted to use the golden urn process suggested by the Qing emperors to select the 11th Dalai Lama, but this had never been actually used before. In this process, the elder monks would still go out and find candidates for the 11th Panchen Lama, but the candidates' names would be placed in a golden urn and then drawn. Surprisingly, the CCP would still let the Dalai Lama be involved in the process, but he would not be the final person to pick the candidate. The Dalai Lama wanted to be done in the traditional way, where he would consult the oracle and then they would pick who the final candidate would be. The Dalai Lama's traditional process selected a boy named Gedhon Cheoki Naima, but he would announce this right before the CCP would pick their candidate through the golden urn method. As a result, the CCP took this boy in 1995, and no one has seen him since. The CCP still went through with their golden urn method and selected their own candidate, Gyenkeng Norbu. The selection of the 11th Panchen Lama shows the juxtaposition between the 14th Dalai Lama and the CCP. I think the way that this process went down highlights how the CCP wants to be in control of the religious processes in Tibet to use it for a hegemonic function to help their control of the area. They think that if they can have some control over the religious leaders because they selected them, then they can have a better control over the Tibetan people. The communist government associates the civil unrest in Tibet with the unruly nature of its religious leaders and their opposition towards the Chinese Communist government. Coming off the 11th Panchen Lama incident of the 1990s, the 2010s haven't brought any more peace between the Dalai Lama and the Chinese Communist Party. In 2012, a Chinese bureaucrat was quoted as saying, "A wolf in sheep's," was quoted as saying that the Dalai Lama was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And in 2015, over 150 Tibetan nationalists set themselves on fire in protest of Chinese rule in Tibet. So it doesn't appear that tensions will ease over anytime soon between China and Tibet. So the question is, what will happen as the Dalai Lama reaches almost 81 now? What will happen when he passes away, and how will his successor be chosen? The Dalai Lama has given multiple answers to this question, although most of the time he says he doesn't wish to comment on it. The Dalai Lama has said that the people should decide, or that the Dalai Lama system as itself will come to an end, or that the next Dalai Lama will be born in India. Of course, China has come on the record and said that the next Dalai Lama will be born in China. So I think that the next Dalai Lama will be born, or the next incarnation of the Dalai Lama, we will have two Dalai Lamas, one chosen by the CCP and then one chosen by the Tibetan government in exile. Using the incident with the Panchen Lama as a guide, it seems to me that both parties are going to end up doing what they want to do or what they believe is right. The Chinese Communist Party will do what's best for them and their interests in Tibet, and the Tibetan government exile will do what's best for them and their interests in Tibet. The situation in Tibet seems almost untenable, with both parties being able to make some sort of historical claim to have ownership or rule over that area. The Chinese Communist Party can draw a history line back to the Qing Dynasty, even though it was a weak rulership between Emperor Kangxi of the Qing Dynasty over Tibet. And the Tibetan government exile can draw back to the third, fourth, and fifth Dalai Lama, well, mainly the fifth Dalai Lama, of having their historical claim to ruling over Tibet. So just to recap, we went over why Tibet has a claim to claim over an independent. The Tibetan government exile has a claim over an independent Tibet, thanks to the fifth Dalai Lama. China also believes it has a claim to Tibet due to the Qing era and its Emperor Kangxi's conquering of that. We also went over the 14th Dalai Lama and the CCP and how they split during the 1950s. Then we went over the Panchen Lama an incident of the 1990s. In conclusion, we've come to the conclusion that there's no tenable solution for the future to reconcile the CCP and the Tibetan government in exile and the 14th Dalai Lama. And I believe that after the 14th Dalai Lama passes away, there will be two Dalai Lamas, one selected by the CCP and one selected by the Tibetan government in exile.